Well, welcome to our event today. The first thing I'm going to do is to introduce our two speakers, and then I'll go over the format, and then we can get on with what we're going to get on with. First of all, let me introduce Professor Meibom here. Professor Meibom comes from Denmark, and if you know anything about that part of the world, she already has the moral high ground, so perhaps actually starting with a disadvantage for Professor Wright here. Professor Meibom read for her first degree in philosophy at the University of Copenhagen and then for her PhD at the University College London. Professor Meibom has held fellowships at Cambridge and Princeton universities, postdoc at Washington University in St. Louis at the Program for Philosophy, Neuroscience and Psychology. She comes to the University of Cincinnati where she's a professor from Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. Professor Meibom's work and numerous publications have focused on understanding other minds, emotions, empathy, and responsibility. She is currently finishing a book on the nature and use of taking other people's perspectives, entitled Knowing You, Knowing Me. Professor Wright, here on my left, won't recall this, but he's actually written a letter to me ahead of time. This was some time ago, by the way. His letter was a reply to a letter I had sent in which I was asking if he would consider taking me on as one of his PhD students. His terribly gracious response letter was a detailing of the many other opportunities that might be found elsewhere, of which I might avail myself. So, thank you. I appreciate. At least he wrote back. I mean, that's saying something. So anyway, Professor Wright's probably perhaps most well known for his performances on the Northumberland County Under-19 First 15 Rugby Union team. This would be the late 1960s. After those heady days of tackling and punting for penalties, everything sort of plateaued a little bit. Really, for Professor Wright, securing just two bachelor degrees at Oxford Exeter College, and then reading for an MA and a DPhil at Oxford's Merton College, and then later, Professor Wright was awarded a Doctor of Divinity degree by Oxford for his prolific and outstanding work in New Testament theology. His publications are obviously too numerous to mention, but perhaps he is best known in New Testament studies for his 4.5 volumes, series on Christian origins and the question of God. And then outside of New Testament studies is known for many accessible books, including a series for everyone series. Professor Wright is currently, among other things, Professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at St. Andrews University in Scotland. Okay, so the way this is going to work is that they will each have 7 minutes to deliver their personal worldview. And then after that time, I will go through the questions that have been presented to us from the process that's been going on here at UC for the last few weeks. And those questions will be roughly 10 minutes each. There's five of them, so it'd be like essentially a 50-minute discussion. And which, you know, if you want to ask questions about things they are saying, you'll find on your seat a postcard that has a phone number to which you might text a question. At that point, later on, after Professors Meibom and Wright have responded, we will have Lydia back up and she will deliver those questions to our guests and see what they have to say. Okay, so let me start with Professor Meibom over here with her description of her worldview.
Thank you. Can you all hear me? All right, let me position myself. I think that there are two broad ways of thinking about, let's say, what matters in life. One of them is an immanent view that all there is, meaning, beauty, truth, what have you, is in this world. Another is a transcendent view, that it's somehow outside in some extraterrestrial intelligence or something like that. My view is an immanent view with an A, not imminent. It's not just about to arrive. I believe we are evolved biological creatures. We are human animals. We are made of flesh and bone and blood, and we're part of a great chain of being with all other sentient creatures. We're born, we mature, we mate, we have offspring, we experience pain, we experience happiness, and then we die, just like every other creature on this earth. Now, I don't think that that's a particular pessimistic view. I believe that in that view, you find a great fellowship with all living creatures. We're all subject to the same conditions. What we experience, somebody has probably experienced before us. And the joys and the pains is something that most living creatures have experienced. So, in that context, we may ask ourselves, how are we to live our lives? I agree with Aristotle that the ultimate good is happiness. Now, that's not to be taken as in a crude hedonistic sense that we should sort of just, it's just, what do you say, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I think that's a mistaken view of happiness. But the flip side of that, of course, is that there is one thing that is really terrible, and that is suffering. The Buddhists were big on that, if you know Buddhism. And so I think that if we're going to, in a very few minutes, talk about the good and the bad in life, good is happiness, bad is suffering. However, if something is good, like happiness, it's not just good for me, it's good for every creature capable of happiness. The same thing is true of suffering. And so to put things very briefly, I think that what we ought to do is we ought to increase the happiness for all creatures, all living creatures, not just those that we like, that we hang out with, not just our fellow humans, but all creatures capable of happiness and suffering. Now, of course, it's all very easy to have these sort of lofty ideals, you know. And so the question is, how do we implement that on the ground? And there, I'd like to turn to the sort of ancient Greek practices that you see in Stoicism, where you have a daily practice that they, in fact, call meditation. Some of you might have read Marcus Aurelius' Meditations or have read some of Seneca. And the idea here is that you engage in a daily practice where you reflect upon your life, you reflect on what you think the fundamental values are and how you have managed to implement those values in your life during that day. Just in your interactions with other people, in your emotional reactions. And in that way, I think you can actually achieve real change. But I think that the idea that the Stoics had of a daily practice, not just a one-off decision where you think, okay, I got to do better, when you feel really bad about having done something, that is not really the way to go. One of the things that I also think that the Stoics had right was that they thought one of the important things is a therapy of desire, a therapy of emotions. So we don't get stuck in a cycle of action and reaction. So we get angry and we lash out and we cause more suffering. A lot of times we can stop out and reflect on how we're feeling, whether that actually reflects reality. For instance, somebody like Seneca wrote, I think, a wonderful piece on anger that I highly recommend for anybody to read. Lastly, I do, of course, as a philosopher, I'm big time into truth and questioning and seeing if we can look at things a different way, whether we can explore different ways of living that may be better for everybody considered. So that is, I think, is also a good thing to include in our daily practice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is this coming through? Here at the back? Yeah, good. Thank you. waving. Does that mean yes or no? Yes, good. Okay, thank you. I'm very delighted to be here. It's the first time I've done anything here at U of C. I have been in Cincinnati before, but not for a long time, and it's good to be back and add my thanks to those who've organized this and laid it on. This wonderful question about the big questions and your personal worldview in 7 minutes starting now is a huge challenge. As I reflect on human life, and as I look at human life being lived in the world as a whole, and in my family, and my children, and my grandchildren, and the society that I know, and other societies of which I hear, there are certain key features which everybody is interested in, and everybody is puzzled about. And I'm interested in the universality of that interest, and the universality of that puzzlement. And I've listed them. Seven features as justice, spirituality, relationships, beauty, freedom, truth, and power. Now, more or less all humans cross-culturally are more or less interested in all of those things, and I think this is why philosophers do what they do, and by the way, part of my first degree is in philosophy, so I was glad to hear about Seneca and people who are old friends. That we are all puzzled about them, and I'm just going to give you the example of justice, that we all know that justice matters. If you imagine living in a society with no justice all the time, then that is an absolute nightmare. At the same time, even though we all are signed up to that in theory, both societally and internationally and in our personal relationships, we find it very difficult to achieve, and if we are involved in a particular justice issue ourselves, we are always inclined to give ourselves the benefit of the doubt. And even though we all know we do that, we still do it anyway. And so justice is something we all say yes to, but we all find it difficult. And I would say the same about the others, so I'm not going to take the time to spell that out, except perhaps to say about freedom and truth, that freedom is again something that most human beings cross-culturally would say, yeah, that's a good thing, but what exactly it consists in and what we are free from and what we are free for, these are actually much harder to figure out, even theoretically, and harder still to figure out in practice. And truth, well, if you're in a contemporary university, as you know, in the words of a famous book, truth is stranger than it used to be. Truth is not simply the sum total of agreed facts, but actually truth is a more slippery and odd concept than that. And we all know truth matters. One of the reasons we're at university is because this is a place where people ask the big truth questions. And yet, in the things that really matter, it still slips through our fingers. How do we explain this, and how, as humans, do we go about achieving them? In both cases, humans tell stories. Humans are basically storytelling creatures. And you can look at the big stories that have been told. And my colleague has mentioned particularly some of the great philosophical stories from Aristotle and then from the Stoics, who tell a story about the way the world is and a story about the way humans are within that world. And it seems to me that each of the great stories told by the great philosophers and the great religions is, in a sense, a way of constructing a narrative within which we can make some sort of sense of justice, freedom, truth, and all the others. And for me, the Christian story makes an interesting kind of sense. It isn't that the Christian story gives you a knockdown answer to all those questions so that there's nothing more to think about. Far from it. In my experience, the Christian story raises fresh questions in all sorts of directions. But as it does so, it plugs into the ancient Israelite story, which comes through in first century Judaism, in which, unlike the Epicureans in one direction, unlike the Stoics in another direction, they believe that heaven and earth are meant for one another. They go together. They are supposed to be complementary. They are the two parts of a good creation. And that all human beings living on earth in the immanent world are nevertheless aware in some way or other of things which don't really work if all you have is an immanent world, and hence they are looking for something different and beyond, and yet something which isn't very far away from any of us. And within the Jewish world and then within the Christian world, this is talking about a God who makes a world, a God who wants human beings to live in that world wisely because they bear God's image, and a God who will one day call time on the whole thing by producing a renewed creation in which justice and truth and peace and freedom and all those other things will actually be enhanced and completed in some sense, which it's actually hard for us to describe, but then many important things are hard for us to describe. So that within all of that, the Christian vision, which I hold, of the place of human beings is of being image bearers, because if you're in the ancient pagan world, you build a temple to your God, and the last thing you put into that temple is an image of the God, so that the influence of the God may be there in the world, and so that the world may see who the true God is through the image. And this is the picture which we have from the book of Genesis right on through, radically renewed in the New Testament, that God made a sort of temple called heaven plus earth, called the cosmos, the creation, and put into that temple an image, namely human beings, so that we are supposed to be reflecting God into the world and reflecting the world back to God. And in the Jewish story, this is a project in search of an ending. And in the Christian story, the climax to that, not a conclusion exactly, but certainly a climax, comes with Jesus of Nazareth, who is the true image, the truly human being, and who, in mysterious ways, is also the living embodiment of Israel's creator God. And when Jesus does what he does, particularly his launching of God's kingdom, his death and his resurrection, and his sending of the Spirit, then people are energized in a new way, not so much for Aristotle's happiness, though that's really important as a kind of a byproduct. In the Christian language, that might be part of what is meant by joy, not quite the same thing as eudaimonia, happiness, but not too far away. But we are energized in order to be genuine human beings, which is to reflect the living God into the world, and in the terms of praise and worship, to reflect God back to the world. And as I reflect on that larger story and see how it relates to or bounces off the other story that people have told from time to time, I find a deep satisfaction both in being part of that narrative myself and in observing the way in which at least it reframes and points towards an answer to those questions about justice, spirituality, relationships, beauty, freedom, and truth, and power. So, there we are.
I'm wondering if it's correct then, before we go off into the questions, to just reflect for a moment on how you both position the human in your respective worldviews. Is it fair to say that Professor Maibaum, that the elevation of humanity above the rest of the world, the living creatures and whatnot, is really a function of the narrative that we've told ourselves because of our intellectual preeminence and so on and so forth? Or would you say that there is a uniquely held position for humans? And then for Professor Wright, in his description, clearly Professor Wright has an elevated role, a unique role for humans insofar as they become image bearers. So if I've been thinking about a distinction between the two guests, I think it's the location of the significance of being a human. Would you care to respond to that, Professor Maibaum?
I will do my best. I tend to think that the thinking of ourselves as being extra special is a bit self-congratulatory, right? It's in our interest. Of course, we would think that we're special. If there is a God, it really loves us more than everything else, etc. And so it's a sort of expanded egotism in a certain sense. On the other hand, I think that there's no doubt that we are amazing creatures, right? We have incredible brains. We have changed the entire world. In some respects, we have changed it for better. In some respects, of course, we've also caused the most evil that any species on this planet has caused. So it depends a little bit on where you want to place a special status, I would like to say. I think that one of the things that I don't like about human exceptionalism is the cruelty that we expose other non-human animals to.
I thoroughly dislike and disapprove of that as well. And I don't know whether I laid myself open to the specific charge, though I could kind of see it coming, of a kind of selfish exceptionalism, which is a real problem. And many people have pointed out that people who have exploited the natural world, including non-human animals, have tried to claim the authority of Genesis chapter 1 and other similar passages to do that. My problem with that is that the more I see, both in the Bible and in the wider Christian tradition, about what I think is a genuine Christian doctrine of God as creator, is that it is about God's generous love, and that the image-bearing thing is not about exalting humans over the natural world, but about a responsibility, a stewardship of and for that world. And as you say, the extraordinary capacity humans have is then seen both in when humans really get that right and then in when they get it wrong, when selfishness takes over and instead of stewardship, it becomes exploitation or even worse. So that I would say that that capacity for generous love is the thing about God the Creator, which above all else is revealed in the vocation which humans have to look after the world. And looking after can sound patronizing, but as you say, since we are demonstrably significantly different, maybe that does constitute some kind of a responsibility. And then, of course, the theme of generous love is precisely what, for Christians, is embodied radically and shockingly in Jesus himself. So I very much take what you say as it were, an exposition of what in Jewish and Christian thought would be the problem of evil, or in specifically Christian thought, the fall, that there is something wrong, and that we are part of that and have contributed to it. But that doesn't mean there wasn't a true vocation in the first place.
I guess I would disagree with a sort of deeper vocation idea, I suppose, although I do think that with the kind of power and intelligence that we have, we do have a responsibility. We do have a responsibility to treat the world, if I may say so, rather broadly, much better than we do, and much less selfishly.
Okay, thank you very much. So we're going to go to the prepared questions now. Our first question for our guests is how do we know what we know? So have a go at that. You've got 5 minutes each or a 10-minute conversation. Which six way, yeah.
How do we know what we know? This is, of course, one of the big philosophical questions, and since I'm with a professional philosopher, I'm kind of nervous to see what's going to happen here. But let me put my head on the chopping block. I mean, traditionally, you can do this either upwards or downwards. You can either start with, well, I know that there's a stage here because I can feel it and see it. There's a water bottle and a this and a that, and then gradually build up to some sort of a bigger picture. Or I can start with ideas in my head about the way the world is, which I then test out and try sort of experiments to see if that does in fact correspond to the reality all around me. And obviously the problem of knowledge, the question of what's known in the trade as epistemology, the theory of knowledge, has gone this way and that down the years. And part of the problem is do I actually know that this is a stage, or am I simply dreaming it, or am I simply part of somebody else's experiment, some mad psychiatrist who is manipulating my brain so that it looks as though there's a stage here, etc., etc. Now, these sorts of questions are common coin in some philosophical circles, at least. And I want to register a gentle protest against some of that, and say that we're missing an element here, and it's the element of love, because the danger with talking about knowledge is that it either tries to get to an unattainable objectivity, where I get out of the picture entirely and I'm simply telling you objectively what is out there, which is actually unattainable, or it collapses into subjectivity, to which somebody can say, well, you only think that because it suits your interests, that it may be true for you, but it's not true for anyone else, etc., etc. And I want to say that in many philosophical traditions, and certainly in mine, the notion of love transcends that subject-object divide, because when I genuinely love someone or something, I celebrate what it is or what that person is in themselves, but at the same time, this is not in my own interests, in the sense that if it is, then it isn't love, it's simply manipulation of some sort. And I want to say that actually when you run an epistemology of love through, whether it's scientific knowledge, whether it's artistic knowledge, whether it's theological knowledge, it then sheds light in both directions on the nature of the ideas we have, which then can get tested out in ordinary everyday reality, or on the question of how we know what we know, which is in front of us. So I would want to put love back into the picture, and I observe that in Western culture over the last 200 years, love has been systematically screened out. The old Faust legend had as one of its features that when Faust makes a pact with the devil, the deal is you must not love. You'll get all kinds of other wonderful things, but you must not love. And I think one of the reasons why the Faust legend has been so important in the modern world, from Goethe to Thomas Mann and beyond, is precisely because it reflects something profound about contemporary Western culture. Maybe I'll stop there and see how my philosopher friend.
Well, I would want to say I love love as much as the next person, which would be you. but I would be perhaps. Am I too loud? Is that the problem? Okay. But I guess I'm not entirely sure how that works with knowledge. I'm writing a book right now on taking other people's point of view, and it turns out that in relationship, the most important predictor of relationship satisfaction is that you feel understood. But that bears no relationship to actually being understood. So it certainly seems that there is a shortcoming in understanding, even in love. So I would like to at least keep love and what we know to some extent separate. It seems to me that a number of things that we do know, we do learn through our feelings. I think our feelings can be very wise that way. So I think sort of a kind of pure intellectual knowledge entirely shorn off our physicality and our emotional being is probably a misunderstanding, at least if we want to understand everything, right? Perhaps if we want to understand things about the universe, how planets work, etc., that, you know, we can do it in a different way. But I guess at heart, I'm a sort of empiricist, so the empiricist famously said, there's nothing in the mind that wasn't previously in the senses. Now, I do think that our minds are made in a certain way, so there are certain things we like more than others, and there are certain things that we find difficult to grasp. So I imagine that most of you have problems grasping the fundamental particle wave duality that, as far as we know, is the underlying nature of the atom that builds up everything around us, right? That is something that our minds are not well equipped to fully grasp. Then there are other things that we like that come easier to us, that seem more satisfying because it's familiar. I think that one of the tasks that we have when we try to move forward in knowledge is that we question things or truths that seem to come to us easily and test them, that we have public discourse, that we have a certain methodology that we can all agree on so we can have public discourse, and that we don't simply rely on easy fixes or easy truths, or that we only want to believe what we want to believe, what we feel comfortable with. I think that we're at a point in history where we know more than any other humans before us, and we can make great use of that knowledge, and it doesn't seem quite that we are, because that knowledge is uncomfortable or unwelcome to some. But I guess to conclude, I think we know what we know through simple method of using our senses, forming theories, testing those theories, and engaging with other people who do the same thing. And what we learn is accumulative, right? We're standing on the shoulders of maybe not giants, but the shoulders of a lot of normal-sized human beings all stacked up.
Yeah, I think it's fair enough, but I think the engagement point, particularly important. I mean, in my business, New Testament scholarship, it's basically a branch of ancient history, trying to figure out what these people thought and meant. And I would be very interested to hear you on discovering what's going on with other minds. I'm not sure if that's my mic or I'm just holding it still, so I'm sorry about the crackles. But I think as we do that, it's what I mean by love is part of that engagement with other knowers who are also trying to know things at the same time as we are and who will say, no, you've got that wrong or you've forgotten that bit of evidence or whatever. But it's also the kind of generosity of the relationship with the evidence itself, whether it's the observation of planets, letting the planets be what they are and letting them surprise us, unlike the kinds of astronomers who've got their fixed theories and we're going to make sure the data conform to that. And then mutatis mutandis in all sorts of other fields as well, having the generosity of spirit to allow the data to, as I say, to surprise us and perhaps to shock us, but at the same time, not imagining that this is objective in the sense of it's just out there and I'm just a fly on the wall observing it, but recognizing I am in a relationship with this data in some sense or other, and that therefore I have to be self-critical about that, and I have to allow myself to hear the critical voices saying, are you sure you're not just manipulating us? So that's part of what I mean by love in that context. And as I say, I think we have got into a bit of a trap in the Western world. We certainly do in our generation know far more than has been known, and half of it, goodness, is out there in distorted form on Wikipedia. But the question is, what are we going to do with that?
I guess the way that I look at things is we're trying to move in a certain direction. We're trying to move towards more objectivity. I think that you're right. Absolutely. Objectivity is a in a certain sense a pie in the sky. But we can do better and we can do worse. And what we aim to is exactly, I mean, you call it love. I guess I wouldn't perhaps necessarily put it that way. I mean, I think the Buddhist has a way of talking about emptiness, how objects are empty. And if I understand it correctly, the idea is that we should try and see things how they are in themselves, as opposed to simply a foil for our projections. And I take it that that's some of the things that you are talking about.
I think so, but I think for a Christian epistemology, insofar as I would articulate it, I would say I shouldn't be trying to say something which is not my point of view. There is no such thing as a point of view which is nobody's point of view. And we can have different points of view of the same object, and we can talk together about that. And there's a lovely line in an old English poem about painters in God's new world who will paint the thing as they see it for the God of things as they are. In other words, there's a sort of epistemological humility which says that only God actually sees them as they really are, but God wants us to paint the thing as we see it, to bring our perspective on what we're looking at into the public world, into the public space, and perhaps in the form of beauty, not least. Now, there's a to and fro to be had there, but we may have gone as far as we can get down that track.
So might I just clarify, when you were saying love is a part of the epistemological mechanism, and you effectively are using that metaphorically to describe a disposition to the object that we must know, and then Professor Maibaum took that to be, oh, this is, you know, a way in which we can sort of relinquish ourselves of our own narratives and stop using the object as a foil for reinstituting those narratives. But then you mentioned, Professor Wright, that, oh, but we still must have a point of view. So are you suggesting that we should still retain something even though we're sort of subordinating ourselves?
I think part of the human vocation is to take responsibility for speaking the truth as we see it, while having the humility to hear other voices which may say, you need to modify that, or you need to get rid of that and do something else instead. So it's the responsibility to say, this is how I see it, and I'm going to articulate it as clearly as I can, and I'm going to confess any particular interests, personal interests that I have in this, to make sure that if that's distorting, you can all see that, etc., etc. But the point about love, then, is that it's neither purely objective nor purely subjective, and that to think of knowledge as either objective or subjective is to try to put the wind of love into a rather rationalistic bottle, and I just don't think that works.
Thank you. Okay, our next question is, I'm going to jump down to question number 3 here. Who are we? We had to have a conversation about, well, how do we understand this question? Right, and I think we've arrived at something. Let's start with Professor Maibaum here.
The way that I took it was to be a question about personal identity, because I've taught courses on personal identity. And then, of course, I think, well, who are we? Well, we're human animals. What makes us the kind of creatures that we are is our consciousness. That probably includes, I would say, consciousness of the world outside us, self-consciousness. It includes having projects that extend over time, having goals, having values, and so on. Now, a question might be, how do we persist through time, right? So philosophers like to talk about the question of what matters in survival. Now, that doesn't mean surviving death, but it means surviving from one moment to the next, right? So what makes you the same person from one act? As we all know, at any one moment, we have one act of consciousness, and then we have another that follows. What makes that part of the same thing, right? Somebody like Locke said, oh, it's our memory, the fact that we can recall having had thoughts earlier on and so forth. I think a lot of philosophers would now like to add extra things because, of course, our memories really aren't that good. And if we're relying on that, we're really not going to sustain ourselves very long over time. And so one might add, what makes you the person that you are over time is having similar values, or at least having values that change in a sort of gradual and identifiable way, and so forth and so on, right? Now, one of the things that I wanted to push with this line is the thought of a favorite philosopher of mine, Derek Parfit, who worked on personal identity. He poses a lot of thought experiments about division of selves. So suppose, for instance, that I have a terrible accident, and part of my body is destroyed. Now, for some reason or other, perhaps there's a shortage of female philosophers, they decide to reconstitute me in two different bodies, right? And so now the question is, am I the one person, I am the other, am I both, or have I ceased to exist altogether? Parfit calls this an empty question because there's no further fact of the matter that we can learn about this particular thing. But it does seem as if it would be rational or sensible for me to care about both. And in a certain sense, I have expanded. Now I can do more. I can fulfill more projects. But I think that what that suggests is that what matters to survival is not uniqueness, that it's the very same thing, but it's other things. Values that we have, intentions, experiences, and happiness. And one of the things that Parfit sees his view as doing is breaking down the barrier between subjects. So we come, in a certain sense, we can use this way of thinking to liberate us a little bit from the sort of egocentricity or egoism that we're all inevitably caught up in. And of course, that is also closely related to, I think, the Buddhist idea of the no-self, where realizing that the self, to some extent, is an illusion, will liberate us from a very narrow-minded focus on ourselves and us getting more and us being happy, and extending that out to other creatures.
That's fascinating. When I read this question, who are we, my mind went back to a different philosopher, namely Descartes, and said, I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum. And much of Western philosophy for the last 400 years has been, in a sense, footnotes to Descartes, including, obviously, Locke's very interesting discussion of personal identity. But again, my fear with that is that it's led us into a sort of rationalism, and that actually a Christian response, and Descartes was a devout Christian, I'm not saying he was a pagan or was denying the faith or anything, he was indulging in a thought experiment, which was also an experiment about thought and what you could deduce from the fact of thought. And I want to say, again, at the risk of sounding like a cracked gramophone record, amor ergo sum, I am loved, therefore I am. And I put it that way rather than I love, therefore I am, though I would say that as well, because it seems to me that as humans, we discover who we are when somebody loves us or some creature loves us. It might be a dog. It might be some other non-human creature who makes us feel more truly who we are, but ideally in some kind of a family or friendship or ecclesial or communal context, we discover who we are because of other people's love at whatever level. And it seems to me that has to do with the Christian idea, which in the nature of the case is not just a Christian idea, but sheds light on other things, of being made in order to be part of a community, of discovering who we are within and for a community. Because, of course, if you are loved, then the most natural thing to do is to love in return, and in turn to be part of that wider community of love. Now, one of the biblical phrases which sums up a lot of what it means to be human is a rather odd-sounding technical phrase called the royal priesthood. The priests and kings in the ancient world were the crucial mediators between the divine and the human, between the transcendent and the immanent or whatever. But in the book of Genesis, the idea of this hierarchy, these very few people in a society who mediate between God and the world, is democratized. And all humans are to be people who stand in between, at the convergence of heaven and earth, with heaven seen here not a la the Epicureans as a long way away, but a la the Jews as the thing which is the other dimension, which is mysterious, which is around us, and which actually desires to make its home with us, so that as Jesus taught us to pray, thy kingdom come on earth as in heaven. So for me, humans are discovering constantly who they are by loving and particularly by being loved, and in that process stand at the intersection of heaven and earth with responsibilities, as it were, in both directions. And the responsibility of caring for other creatures, which you approached in what you said through the Buddhist idea, I'm not quite sure how that emptying of self really works, but maybe you can say more about that. For me, it's more about actually discovering the extraordinary value of a self, but the paradoxical value, because the most important thing you can do with yourself is to give it away, and that is what love is all about.
Did you want to respond to that, Professor Mogul?
Yes, I had a clear idea of what I was going to say just a couple of minutes ago, but let me see if I can.
Well, while you're talking, I'll just say Professor Maibaum actually just alleviated a great concern I've had about teleporting, because as I watch Star Trek and then wonder about the day I'm going to be teleported, I think about that moment where I get dissolved but I appear somewhere else and think, is that really me? What's happening? But apparently it is me. I just maintain my values and so on and so forth.
Well, I mean, so Derek Parfit has a famous example with his, which is a teletransportation example, right? And after he goes through his various examples, his final conclusion is that ordinary survival is no worse than teletransportation. We change. I mean, so this is, of course, another sort of Buddhist idea, but it's also a very philosophical idea. If you remember Heraclitus, you never step in the same river twice. Everything is change. We change all the time.
And I think that's something that, stated boldly like that, a Christian can say absolutely, because we are within time. This may be moving on to the next question or back to question two, which we reverse the order of, that where are we? We are in a world which is in a state of flux, and we ourselves are in a state of flux. As we know, every molecule in your body changes over more or less 7 years, so that you are quite literally not physically the same person as you were a decade ago. And I assume, I'm not a physiologist at all, but I assume that that includes brain cells, that they're being renewed and restored, and that nevertheless they have some sort of memory, even though, you're right, the more we know about memory, the more we realize how unreliable it can be, but that there is continuity, such that if that continuity is broken by, say, a terrible accident of another sort, which results in somebody having, as we say, a different personality, then there is a real shockwave goes through the community of other lives that that person then touches or is touched by, where they don't know who this is anymore. And when somebody has had a really serious illness, that is a problem. And I think one of the reasons we find dementia so difficult to deal with in families and so on is because this doesn't seem to be the same person that we had known and loved. And it seems to me that's part of the brokenness of the world, to which the only answer, of course, is more generous love, more ability to go out to meet this person where they now are and to assure them of safety and love and so on. Though that's tough. But I think that is part of some of the most alive people I have ever known are people who, in that sense, make sure they are going out and living for others and looking out for others, and who, as a result, seem to grow in themselves precisely because they're not taking themselves in a selfish sense seriously.
I take it that the part of the no-self view in Buddhism is very similar. That this kind of notion that we have of a self that's completely separate from others and so forth and so on is an illusion, that there is a self that abides through time, that you are exactly, in some interesting sense, exactly the same person that came out of your mother's womb and so forth and so on. I think we have a lot of mistaken ideas about that. And one of the things that I think we can do is, if we think really seriously about it, I think we realize that not only is that an illusion, but that also shows the interconnectedness with other people and the world around us in a way that we like to kid ourselves. This is just me, this is this, that, and the other, but everything that you do potentially affects other creatures, other fellow beings, and so on.
And I think at this point there is a Christian critique of the modernist idea of the self. You know, the modernist idea is, I am the master of my fate, I am the captain of my soul, I am who I am, and I'm just coming through and doing my thing and get out of my way. That kind of modernist arrogance, which I think goes back particularly to certain 18th century European attitudes, but is very prevalent still in some quarters. Postmodernity responds to that by saying that the self is just a mass of shifting signifiers and different narratives that swirl to and fro, and that we actually reinvent ourselves the whole time. And the Christian response to both of those, I think, would be, in traditional language and practice, to talk about baptism, that something happens at the moment of initiation, however you do that and so on, in which, at least from a theological theory, you actually cease to be as your primary identity, the person that you were, and become a new person in some sense or other, a person in Christ, a member of the Messiah's family, a member of this new, large, multi-ethnic, very odd-shaped family, and that is now your primary identity, that you are, that the self you now are is now one who is formed and reformed within that new world. It's about new creation, ultimately, and finding of the self within the new creation, which nevertheless enables the self as it's always been since it was conceived in its mother's womb, to grow and become more fully the human being that it was designed to be. But obviously we're moving on there into quite other areas.
Right, well, given those things, let's get on to the next question, which is, What's wrong with the world?
G.K. Chesterton, great British writer from 100 years ago, wrote a letter to the London Times because somebody had written an article on what's wrong with the world. And the way that you signed letters to the editor of the Times in those days was you said, I am yours sincerely, N.T. Wright or whatever. And Chesterton wrote, Sir, what is wrong with the world? I am yours sincerely, G.K. Chesterton. Which is a cheap and cheerful way of saying something profoundly Christian, which is that when you ask the question, what's wrong with the world, you do not sit on a position of moral neutrality yourself and say, if there's wrong in the world, it's all out there, but I am the one who can sit above it and judge it. We are all in this mess together, and if we are talking about what's wrong in the rest of the world, we have to be prepared to have the critique bounce back at us. That would be move number one. Perhaps I'll pass over before we move to moves number two, three, four.
Right. Yes, I agree with the, you know, to say that what's wrong with the world, you could answer, say nothing, except for us. I mean, that would be one way of looking at it. Of course, a lot depends on what you expect the world to be and whether your expectations are in fact false. Right? So that's one thing. But I guess I would come up with some suggestions. Why not? Lack of compassion, egotism, greed, the illusion that what we do, we have a right to do, no matter how it affects others around us, the idea that the world or the environment is out there and whatever happens out there is not going to affect us, anger, aggression, hatred, the division that we've seen increasingly, I think, in the United States, the political partisanship that leads to incredible derogation of the other side, of hatred of fellow citizens and so on. I mean, those are just some suggestions. I don't know what you want to add to the list.
Well, yeah, I mean, naturally, I don't like any of those things either. And I'm tempted to be very aggressive towards the people who embrace them. But I liked your opening point, particularly about false expectations, because I think most human beings, most of the time, would think that there is something wrong with the world. And even if we accept the obvious problem spots in the world, like sort of Syria or wherever at the moment, nevertheless, there is a sense of a malaise which, despite all our education and our intelligence and our smart machines and all the rest of it, we don't actually seem to have made any advances at all in terms of some pretty basic human qualities. However, the idea of false expectations raises the question, why should we think there's something wrong with the world? I mean, some philosophers have said that actually we live in the best of all possible worlds and there couldn't be anything better than what we are in at the moment. And if we rebel against that, they would say, you're just living in a fantasy land. You want to be cosseted. You want to be in Disneyland all the time, where everyone is sort of nice to you and gives you hamburgers every time you want them and whatever. And you just don't like the world because it's not like that. And I want to say, from a Christian point of view, there is this thing called the problem of evil, which actually goes much wider than the things you mentioned, to include, classically, things like earthquakes and tornadoes. I'm shocked to see tornado safe zones there. Okay, let me know if you see one coming, because we British don't know about those things usually. But actually, if you're an atheist, then you have a problem of good. Why should there be in a random world things like love and beauty and things that make the heart sing? Why should are they just a cruel joke? Are they just evolution's trick, making us think that there is meaning to life when in fact there isn't? So we can probe that a bit further. So I think behind all the symptoms which you mention, then for the Christian, there would be an analysis which says that humans are out of joint with the way they're meant to be, and that some of that out of jointness contributes to a larger out of jointness in the world as a whole. Now, you can't say that because humans are fallen, whatever that means, that that's why earthquakes happen. It seems to me that earthquakes, etc., are part of the way that God has made the world, because the world is not made like an 18th century machine designed to work like clockwork with God as the clockwork maker. That's actually a very modern idea of how God made the world. But nevertheless, there is a sense which comes through in some key biblical passages that creation itself is waiting for a new day, a new world to be born, and that we see signs of that in the present, not least in human love, but then specifically in the story of Israel and the story of Jesus, and particularly his death. We see things which say, there is a God who is going to make a new world, and we get to be part of that. And that merely increases the sense of slippage, of tension at the moment. Now, of course, that's a faith position, but it seems to me it's the sort of faith position which then, when you take it and look around yourself, you say, actually, that position makes sense of what I'm looking at, of what I can see. And as we were saying before about knowledge, it's not, not as you were saying before, because you confess to an empiricist position where you start from the bottom and work up and make sense of it, yeah? Is that sort of?
Sort of.
Sort of, yeah, okay. I want to say it's neither induction nor deduction, it's more about abduction, that is to say, like the Sherlock Holmes things. Yeah, here's all the evidence, but now we need imagination, we need a story, we need something which will tell us how it all makes sense. And then when we have an intuition, a hypothesis about how it all makes sense, we then notice other bits of evidence which we hadn't noticed before, and so the epistemological circuit goes. And so I want to say, when I look out at the world as a Christian, I see all sorts of things which are wrong, which I see as symptomatic of a larger out-of-jointness, which I believe that the God who made the world is in the business of putting right.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I simply don't see what meaning positing some kind of, if you don't mind me saying so, paternalistic figure, much like a father who has created the world, is going to give the world. I don't see it. That doesn't make it any more meaningful to me that somehow we're supposed to reflect his glory or whatever the story is. That to me gives no more meaning than not having it. There's a question, well, why would God be there? Why would there be a supernatural creature that looks so suspiciously like your dad? And where's your mom anyway? Where's she gone? I mean, there is something about that whole story that to me, you know, insofar as I find religious or spiritual idea attractive, I'm much more on the mystical side or the Gnostic side even. You know, God is within you. And the devil or the bad is within you. It is not something external. It is not some kind of external existence, some kind of male figure or anything like that. If there was, I mean, I find the whole question of supernatural beings kind of puzzling. I think once we start thinking harder and harder about it, we might go with, you know, if you know Maimonides, Guide to the Perplexed, a Jewish philosopher, he would ask questions like, it says in the Bible, God turns his back. What sense does that make? Does God have a back? Right? And so there's lots of questions here where, you know, it seems to me that the way that we've conceived religion is a reflection of the limitations of our ways of thinking.
That's exciting, and I'm glad you included some of the new elements in that, because the whole question of Gnosticism was a major problem, obviously, in the Christian world of the second and third century. Gnostic basically comes from the Greek word, which means to know, and the Gnostics were people who believed that they had got secret knowledge about who they were, about the way the world was, etc., which meant that, as you say, there was something inside themselves which was a kind of a spark of light. And I see, inevitably, I see that as a parody of a Judeo-Christian truth, and obviously your parody of a Judeo-Christian God as somebody who looks rather like your dad, which leaves your mum out of consideration, etc., etc. I mean, actually, curiously, there are lots of us Christians who have never really seen God as like, I'm sure I didn't see God as like my dad, or vice versa. That wasn't an issue. However, I'm not saying that lots of people haven't made that mistake, But this is why in the New Testament it says again and again that actually God is a puzzle. We don't know who God is until we look at Jesus. And sooner or later, all these questions come back to Jesus. Now, there's a problem about that as well, because particularly in some Christian circles, there's a sort of sense of whatever the question is, Jesus is going to be the answer to it. So you don't just have to stick up your hand and say Jesus, and it'll probably be right in Sunday school. The New Testament is saying something much more subtle than that, that Jesus is actually an extremely interesting human being, if I could put it like that without seeming myself to be patronizing. But that as you look at Jesus, the New Testament is saying, God has been a bit of a puzzle. And sometimes he seems to be absent, and sometimes maybe it's just a voice inside your head and you're not sure. But when you see Jesus, then you start to get a fresh idea of who God might be. I actually did one of these debates a few years ago with one of your colleagues in Yale, and we weren't supposed to be talking about Jesus, but he ended up talking about Jesus to me all the time, and which I thought was no bad thing for a supposedly philosophical discussion, because then you get into history and so on. But so for me, it isn't the postulation of a supernatural being. It's the deep awareness that many humans have across cultures that human life has a dimension to it which you can't put into either a test tube or a bank balance, and which catches up with you either when you fall in love or when you hear a wonderful piece of music or whatever. And if an evolutionary biologist says, oh, that's just because you have a distant ancestral memory of hearing a tune like that when you were thinking of hunting or something, I just don't get that. I think that's a reductionist, a sort of different kind of reductionism. You weren't saying that, but some might. And I want to say that there are several clues and cues which strike us as humans, which make us wonder about there being more than just, is this all there is? And that into that, there comes the ancient Israelite story, and from the ancient Israelite story about a God who made heaven and earth to work together. See, the natural supernatural distinction is not one that resonates well with the Bible. I think that's a modern way of trying to say something which is in the Bible, but actually distorting it. In the Bible, it isn't supernature and nature. It's creation, which is multifaceted and in which strange things happen and God seems to show up, or some people think he's shown up, and then the story about Jesus kind of brings all that into focus.
I was going to ask you for some response, but also a point of clarification. When you're saying earlier, this is for Professor Maibaum, what's wrong with the world, hatred, violence, these sorts of things, I was going to ask what you thought the source of those things were, like what's behind that, as a way to say that's why these are bad, and by all means respond as well.
Well, I mean, I take it that they're bad because they lead to suffering.
Oh, okay, so the common denominator being if it leads to suffering, that's what constitutes hatred, for example, is bad, and so on and so forth.
Well, I mean, with hatred, we all know it leads to the dark side, right?
I think we do. Let's hope so.
I was gonna say that I think that, I guess I have different intuitions than you have and a lot of other people have. When they look at the world and they see that there's something missing, I don't think that there's anything missing. I think it's only missing if you look at it in rather crude ways. So, sorry, that suggests that you're looking at it in crude ways. But there's a way of looking at the world as a sort of machine that just operates in this kind of crude way, and looking at non-human animals as these creatures that, you know, there is not much going on, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, then you turn television on and you see what remarkable things almost all creatures are capable of. And you look at the beauty of the world and the intricacies of everything. And I don't think we need to look beyond that to find meaning. We can find meaning in fellowship, in each other, in relationships with non-human animals. I find a great joy in my relationship with my dog, for instance. I think he does too. But of course I would say that. So I think that we have a tendency of projecting because of the way our mind works and the way that our understanding works. We usually try to understand one thing by relating it in some way to experiences that we've had before, thoughts that we've had before. And that's one way in which we distort, I think, the world. And meaningful activities and meaning that makes sense within sort of smaller areas of, you know, is it meaningful to read this book? Yes, because you get pleasure of it or you learn something or whatever. We now extend that out, and now there has to be some deeper meaning to life other than perhaps, you know, enjoying it and doing our best to help other creatures enjoy it more too.
The question of the meaning of life is, it's such an easy question to ask. What is the meaning of life? I was on a walk in the Scottish Highlands with some of my family last summer, and my then 7-year-old grandson, Sam, was walking along with me, and we were looking for eagles with binoculars and goodness knows what, and suddenly out of the blue, without warning, he said, "Grandfather, what is the meaning of life?" And to my horror, several other people, both in our party and other people who were walking nearby, stopped to see what I was going to say. And I thought, this is not the moment to start in. But I said, "Sam, let's talk about that a bit later." I wimped out completely and said something silly. But we did come back to it. And even small children are aware of a mystery, of a puzzle. And I mean, I agree that we can say, well, this is simply that we want a bit more meaning, a bit more understanding about how human narratives work. But I think again and again, and it comes cross-culturally, it isn't just sort of Western Christianity or whatever, the sense that we are made for something more than this. C.S. Lewis once said that you can deduce most of theology from the fact that people feel uncomfortable in the presence of a dead body, that there is something uncanny, as we say. There's something wrong. We humans are made for something more than this. And some people have even speculated that clothes that we wear, whether or not it's actually very hot in here, we could all take our clothes off and be more comfortable. And the answer is no. Clothes are an anticipation of the resurrection body, that for a Christian, we are made for something more than what we presently are. This is moving the conversation on from where we were, but it seems to me there are profound intuitions in some of the ancient poetic accounts of Adam and Eve needing to clothe themselves in the garden and that kind of thing, as though this world is a signpost towards something. Every spring, I still feel, even though I know I'm going to feel it, every spring I think, wouldn't it be wonderful if this year spring would turn into a glorious summer which would just go on without the sorrow of fall and the death of the seasons. And that's just probably because I'm at a certain age where I'm kind of getting towards the autumn of my life, and so I kind of resent that. But I think that humans have this intuition about being made for something more. And you may say, well, some humans do and some humans don't. And that's when I would say, ultimately, that for a Christian, it isn't a knockdown argument. Some people have these puzzles, therefore there must be a God. It's some people have these puzzles, therefore let's look at the stories that all sorts of different societies tell, Gnostics, Buddhists, Heraclitus, whoever, and let's put the Christian story into that marketplace of narratives and see if it makes sense, more sense, some sense of the puzzles that many people have. That's the kind of starting point I would have.
So perhaps we could move this on to the last question, which is a response to essentially what you've just said, what's wrong with the world. We're asking for what you think the solution is. It might be good to answer this with reference to personal responsibilities as well as philosophical concepts of what a solution might be as well. Professor Maibaum?
Okay. Well... I think that obviously there are sort of large-scale things that you can do. You can give to charities. You can vote. I was shocked when I realized how few Americans vote. The last Danish election, 96% of people voted. What was it in the last American? Was it in the 40s or something like that?
This is that moral high ground I was mentioning earlier.
Sorry. So there are all the sort of big stuff, right? And I think it's very easy to become sort of a little overwhelmed because clearly there are a lot of problems. And it seems that we can do each individual, one of us, so very little. And so I think maybe what might be more useful to talk about is things that you could do in your everyday life. And I think that you can do things every day to make the world a better place. You can be kind to your fellow beings. You can help somebody who's got a lot of stuff, they're carrying a lot of stuff, opening the door. You can, in various ways, alleviate suffering. My big thing is don't eat any or as little as you can of factory-farmed meat, the way that non-human animals that we consume are being treated today in the Western world, I think, is horrific. And all of these creatures are capable of suffering and of happiness. And so, but I think perhaps one of the most important things is for each one of us to be aware of the sort of greater issues where we find the, what is really valuable, what matters to us. Hold on to that in what I talked about as a sort of daily practice. But I also think that goodness comes in individualized forms, right? So the ancient used to think of virtue as being just like one thing. I think virtue comes in many ways, right? If we look at historical figures over time that we admire, they're often very different, right? They're different things that are close to their hearts. So maybe one thing that you can do is to think of what is really close to your heart. Where do I want to focus my energies as a way of not being overwhelmed as well, right? So do you care? Is your concern the environment? Is your concern animal welfare? Is your concern all the children that go hungry in Cincinnati, right? What is your concern? And then focus your efforts there and then just enjoy, I think, the pleasure that we get out of doing good things for others. And so we each, in our own way, do something every day to make the world a little bit of a better place.
That's a noble vision of a generous, I mean, would you call it altruism? No, perhaps you wouldn't. I worry about the word altruism. It seems a bit cold compared with the word love. But what you're describing is something which, in the Christian tradition, has been enormously highly valued down the years, but is often forgotten by many Christians in the Western world who are so concerned with certain doctrines or whatever that they forget that in any list of Christian virtues, kindness and generosity come pretty high up, and that actually, in terms, I don't know how it is here, I don't know how it is in Denmark, but in Britain at the moment, if you analyze the people who volunteer to do the things in the community that you're talking about and actually give time and energy to it, to the surprise of our cynical secular press, a large number of such people are practicing Christians. And that's not because there's lots of practicing Christians in the country, because there aren't. It's only, you know, church going is at the most about 10% in some cities. But a high proportion of those people are active in doing the sort of things that you mention. And I don't see that as a coincidence, because I'm far from saying that Christians are the only people who do good in society. Absolutely not. St. Paul is very clear in one of his letters that there's all kinds of good stuff going on out there in the wider community, and that Christians should celebrate that and join in and be glad and say this is all part of God's good creation. But for me, the solution lies at least one step, if not two, back from what you said, because there is a certain point at which I can hear myself saying what you said to a group of people who would then go and turn on the television news and say, really, if this politician or that is going to start a thermonuclear war or going to do this or whatever, what's the point going to all that trouble to be nice to people on the street if we're all... So is there a solution to the bigger question? And that's a really tough issue. But then behind all of that, the solution from the Christian point of view is that the God who made the world has launched the project of healing and renewing the world within the middle of history. And this is what the story of Jesus is all about. The kingdom of God, not as an abstract idea, but as a new way of being human, which has been inaugurated and in which we are invited to participate. And in which the best instincts of the best humans of every tradition, such as the ones you've so well articulated, can be affirmed as well. Yes, absolutely, we should be doing that. But the point is, we are doing that, not whistling in the dark while the world goes to hell in a handbasket all around us, but as part of a project which we believe will have a goal, will have a telos. And that's where the virtue thing comes home to roost, because obviously for Aristotle, virtue is a very individual thing, that you have to try to acquire these virtues that make you the perfect, happy human being. And greater love has no one than this than to share his microphone with his friends. Thank you very much. For Aristotle, virtue is an individual thing, and it was aimed at producing leading men for the army, for the society, for generals for the army. So in Christianity, virtue is always a team sport. You can't do it by yourself. It needs to be done in community. And that's why love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, faithfulness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. You can do hardly any of those by yourself. You need to be practicing virtue within a community. So the refounding, the re-energizing of a genuine human community, which then creates a context within which it's easier for people to choose to do the sort of things you were talking about. And having worked in the church as well as the academy for many years, it's wonderful when you see that going on. And when you see people who had been living very self-centered and selfish lives discovering the joy, as you were saying, as I insist, you don't have to be a Christian to do that, but it helps. But when you're a Christian doing it, you celebrate other people doing it as well, because it's part of a larger vision of the whole world.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think that why we should do it is not because it's part of a larger plan, but because that's what we owe to other human beings. For their sake. I do it for your sake, no matter what else is true, because you're a fellow creature capable of happiness and suffering, and I owe you to do that for your own sake. And so I suppose that would be my philosophy, that we, once we understand that others are other selves, as it were, right? We understand the value of other creatures. We understand their pains. We understand their suffering. And then, hopefully, we will be motivated to do things for others for their sake.
To what extent, because obviously you've studied ancient philosophy intensively, to what extent do you think the greatest of the ancient philosophers would have agreed with that? Because when I look at Aristotle, Seneca, whoever, even Marcus Aurelius, I don't actually see that sense that every other human being is valuable and I owe them something. I see a sort of wistfulness about Seneca, but I don't see him actually thinking that his slaves and so on are on the same level as he is, and that he actually owes them something. Because my sense is that quite a lot of the present social concern in the Western world has actually crept up on us without our realizing it from, in some measure, not maybe all, from the Judeo-Christian tradition. So that even where people don't believe in the Christian God, there are still all sorts of... I mean, the value of public education, the value of public health care, I know that's a point of debate in your country, and here we stand on the same high moral ground and say, what are you guys about?
Single-payer health care.
But I mean, in the ancient world, nobody was doing that stuff. The Christians cared for the poor, whoever they were. They tried to provide medical help for people, whoever they were. They tried to provide education. Nobody had ever imagined you could live like that. If we now, broadly in the Western world, with the notable exception of one rather large country, think that all those are good things as well, that's come to us from somewhere, because it isn't there in ancient philosophy. Nobody was doing that in the first century. Is that fair?
In the first century AD,
give or take.
I mean, I'm actually not an ancient historian. I would say that my own view is formed by, obviously, I'm a great fan of the ancient philosophers. I'm also a great fan, if one can say so without sounding too superficial, of the Buddha. but also a lot of recent philosophy, philosophy and in ethics and in politics take very seriously this idea of what we owe to each other in virtue of fellow humanities. Of course, you can think of it a little bit if you want to think back to Kant. Kant also had very much those kinds of thoughts. So I would say that probably my view is an amalgam of a whole lot of different traditions.
And I suppose the standard response to that might be, so are you able to give a response to, say, Machiavelli and others in that tradition who say, actually, the only thing to do is to take what you can, and if that means that you have to tell lies over here and have to manipulate people over there, well, it'll be for the good of you and your tribe, and that's the best you can do. I mean, there's been a great deal in the last generation. Some guy whose name I forget now because I didn't know this conversation was going in this direction, Kaplan, is that right? Robert Kaplan, possibly, who's argued in the States that actually this is how foreign policy ought to be run on lines which go back to Machiavelli and way behind him to Tacitus and ancient thinkers like that.
Let me give you a slightly different response. So I want to bring out another ancient philosopher. You didn't realize this was going to be a philosophy class, did you? And Plato, right? Plato in the Euthyphro asked the following question, right? Is something, he uses the term pious, but I'm going to just say good because I think that is a more contemporary term. Is something good because God loves it, or does God love it because it's good? And there I think the problem is if you just make it the case that something is good because God loves it, it could be anything. It makes good arbitrary. And that, I think, is not what most religious people think. They think God loves the good because it is good. But that means that good is in some way independent of the will of God, right? And that, I guess that would be my position, that we have access to this idea of the good, whether you want to go through it, a religion, or through, well, for lack of a better word, since I am a philosopher, I should say reason.
Yeah, fair enough. There's all sorts of things we could come back, but you probably want to move on. Yeah.
I'm going to test this. Oh, it works. Okay, great. This was your old mic.
Okay.
Actually, this is the end of our questions. I wanted to thank you both for what you've done so far for us, for what you had to say, and your thoughtful responses to these questions. Right now, I believe Lydia is going to come up and provide us with more questions for you, except now from this community of people here.
Great. Well, we just spent the last hour or so talking about five questions. I got about 60 texted to me, so I'll just preface this by saying there's no way we'll get to everyone's question. So I picked a few here. First question is related to time. So what time is it? And another way of asking that is what is significant about the time in which we live?
I
Dr. Wright, would you like to start?
I'll just start by saying, this is not really my special subject, but I've been aware for various reasons that over the last 200 years in Europe and I think America, there's been a strong sense that something happened in the 18th century which transformed really the whole world. The birth of modernity, it happened to be when two particular countries, France and the United States, had their revolutions and drew up new constitutions. And particularly in France, there's been a sense ever since then, that something began at that point, which we are now struggling to complete. And one of the problems that the French have had in their presidential election, which is going on as we speak, is the appeal to the fact that the revolution happened, but we are still not utopia. Utopia has not yet arrived. So how is France going to become the country that it always wanted to be? And other countries have similar things. And I think in America, you have a sort of sense that, yeah, what we did in the 18th century, forget the particular anti-British sentiment going on at that time, was to launch a project which should make, I was about to say, to make America great again. And that anything which is going in that direction is a fulfillment of... So there's a sense of historical time marked out by something that happened in the 18th century. And I want to say very emphatically that that's like a Christian... At best, it's a Christian heresy, because for the Christian, the turning point in history was Jesus and his death and resurrection. And that from the Christian point of view, what matters is figuring out how that gets implemented. And if somebody else says, no, no, the turning point in history was the 1800s or whatever, or the late 18th century, then I want to say, beware, because when people then say, now that we live in the modern world, or now that we live in this day and age, what stunt is being pulled? What narrative are they appealing to? And often it's a kind of a progressive neo-moralism, which I think sustains itself just by being repeated rather than by having any actual wisdom attached to it.
Well, I guess...
Try.
Well, my microphone is out of batteries, luckily. I still got some batteries left. I guess I would like to speak in favor of the greatness of liberal democracy, of which you were the first, although you perhaps did not assign it widely enough, right? So everybody has a right to vote, even if you have a different sexual organ than the ones who founded the country. I think that's an important piece of progress, and the color of your skin, and so forth and so on. I mean, I think one of the great things about liberal democracy is the fact that it allows individuals to explore life, to explore thinking, to be able to speak freely and live the life that they think is best for themselves without interference from others, as long as it does not harm other people. And I think that if we look at a lot of society, well, as most societies up until that point, most societies always have an underclass. It traditionally has always been women, and often there's been slaves or other people who are in some ways disenfranchised. I think the foundational idea of liberal democracy, of the freedom of the individual to explore the best they can, a life to lead that will make them happy, I think is a really fundamentally extremely important thing. And with democracy, well, my faith in democracy has been shaken a bit recently. You know, perhaps we should go back to the philosopher king or queen. I mean, that's just an idea. But by and large, it seems that democracy is probably the best system of governance that we do have. So I would just say hurrah for liberal democracy.
Yeah, and of course I'm not going to disagree with that, though. I mean, it was one of Churchill's sayings that democracy is the worst possible form of government except for all the other forms that have been tried from time to time. In other words, it is not the recipe for utopia. As the Greeks discovered, and okay, it was only male citizens who were voting, but... democracies can do really stupid things, because democracies are vulnerable to demagogues, and they are also necessarily vulnerable to forces within the society which actually want to destroy the democracy. That's the paradox of democracy, that if you're giving everybody a voice and a vote, you have to allow people to say and do things which would in fact destroy the democracy itself. And so it seems to me, democracy is a way of saying we really don't believe in tyranny because it's dehumanizing, but nor do we believe in anarchy because anarchy is, if anything, even worse than tyranny. Ask people who've lived in Iraq for the last 10 years. You know, get rid of the tyrant, yes, fine, but it is not an automatic... And this is part of what time is it? It was Hillary Clinton said when Libya was going through its crisis, it's important to be on the right side of history. And I remember hearing that on the radio and thinking, how do you know which way history is going? And the answer is, it was the standard Western European and North American belief that history is automatically and inexorably moving in the direction of liberal democracy, and all you have to do is take the tyrannical brakes off and liberal democracy will roll in. Doesn't happen like that. And the problem is we do not have an alternative narrative with which to understand the world, let alone, as Marx said, to change it.
Right, so this question is for Dr. Maibaum. In what what hope do you have? And as one with an imminent worldview approaches the end of life, does hope necessarily begin to decline?
I can probably only answer that in some kind of, it'll be a little bit of a platitude, I suppose. You know, I hope that we will get to a place where there's less war, less violence, less hatred. As a matter of fact, Steven Pinker, I think, has written a book that actually shows that we're much less violent now than we were before. So perhaps we can move in that direction. I hope we get to a point where we take better care of each other and of the earth and so on. Now, I think when it comes to dying, I take it that that's going to be part of the question. I don't see that. I mean, obviously, don't shoot me now. But, you know, the inevitable arrival of death, I don't see necessarily as a bad thing. And I would go back to another favorite philosopher of mine, Epicurus. He said, we don't worry about the eons that we were never in existence. Why should we worry about the eons after we're dead that we will not be in existence either? And if dead is a bad thing, something that is bad has to happen to a living thing. But of course, once we're dead, we're dead. So I don't think that we should, if we have my worldview, be concerned about death when it happens. That is not to say, as again, you know, not throw ourselves off cliffs prematurely and so forth and so on. I also think that in our own way, we can think that when we die, we make room for another. We free up resources so other creatures and other people can live and enjoy happiness just as we have. And I think that's a nice thing to think about.
I'm tempted to take you up on Epicurus, but I think we'll probably pass on that one.
Right, but Dr. Wright, this is regarding transcendence. How do we reconcile God's transcendence with his revelation? Are they incompatible?
The usual response, it all depends what you mean by transcendence. I take it that transcendence, that rather sort of fuzzy word, is a way of saying that God is utterly beyond the present world and all its systems, etc. And is, if I say in a different space, that's a metaphor, but I think you may not misunderstand it. And if that's so, then it doesn't automatically create a setting where we can say, now we see, God is transcendent, therefore, ... In other words, we don't know a priori that transcendence would have to mean that God couldn't reveal God's self within our world. Why? Within the ancient Israelite world, the utter distinction between God and the world was coupled right from the beginning with a sense that God wanted to dwell in the midst of the world. Maybe feedback from yours, actually.
Okay.
And that God wanted to be in the midst of his people, and that somehow there was a constant to and fro. And the ancient Jewish texts say this on page after page, that the God who is great and made the universe and made the stars nevertheless wants to dwell with the humble and contrite in heart, and so on. And that to and fro is built in, so that if somebody tries to create a category called transcendence, and then to use that category to problematize the idea of the intimacy and personal love and revelation, self-revelation of God, then I want to say, sorry, you've built into the question something which is actually subtly affecting the answer. And that's where, of course, I would say that we actually only know what these big fuzzy God words mean when we look at Jesus. And that's tough, challenging at every level, personally, epistemologically, and so on. But that's the way to approach it.
Thank you.
And the final... Look, we're so technologically advanced, we have to be attached, right? So the final question is, with what philosophical or theological questions do you wrestle?
Do you want to go first? I mean, the big questions have to do always with God and the world, and the big Christian answers always have to do with Jesus. But as I say, there's a real danger in short-circuiting things and imagining that by playing the Jesus card, there's nothing more to worry about, as it were. And I find again and again, I am drawn to the big questions of, well, in the 18th century, there were a lot of people who thought you could do something called natural theology. That is, that you could start with the world the way it was and reason your way up to God. One of my predecessors as Bishop of Durham, Bishop Butler, famously wrote a book, The Analogy of Religion, one of the finest attempts of that age to do that. Then the Lisbon earthquake happened in the 1750s, 1755, I think so, All Saints' Day, and suddenly a lot of European philosophers who'd been wanting to move in, yes, an Epicurean direction for other reasons, seized upon that and said, no, you can't start with the world the way it is and work up to God. Nevertheless, even though that was then generally recognized, Christians have gone on singing Psalm 19, which says, the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. In other words, there is some sort of nexus between the way the world is and who God is. But how you say that, how you wisely and humbly say that, remains really quite difficult. And it's one of the tasks that I am giving myself to at the moment for various purposes. There's some lectures I have to do and so on. And it seems to me there are issues there which need to be addressed afresh in the light not least of contemporary science as well as contemporary philosophy. And to that, I think biblical studies, which is what I do for a living, has a great deal to contribute, much more than many people who think of themselves as Bible Christians perhaps realize. But these are huge questions, and though it may not be that they're the sort of questions that everybody worries about as they're going home from a lecture or chatting with their roommate late at night or whatever in a university context. Nevertheless, they are the big questions which are kind of out there around the edges of a lot of the other questions that we look at. And so it's kind of exciting to be wrestling with them.
I guess the question that I'm thinking about right now is, how do we understand the other? And I think actually in a curious way that turns back on itself to be, how do we understand ourselves? Because I think part of our self-understanding is taking the position of another on ourselves. So a lot of the literature that I've been reading suggests that when we imagine taking another person's perspective, what we do is we do part projection. Yeah. So we just say, well, what would I feel and think and so forth and so on. And part stereotype. Oh, it's a woman, so she must really want to look pretty or something like that. The really curious and interesting question is, how do we really get to understand others in their alterity? How do we move beyond our own personal projections, as it were, to try and understand that which is truly different? Now, that's not to say, again, I don't think that other people are in some fundamental sense completely different from us, but I think that we often come across points when we talk to other people where we realize that the assumptions that we made about what that person was like and what they were thinking are very, very fundamentally mistaken. And so that's the kind of question that I'm grappling with, and I'm also interested in what it says about our own self-understanding. So we think that, okay, other, I'm perhaps like this because that's what I think other people are thinking. If that's just the result of your projection, how do we get to a greater understanding of that?
Thank you for joining us. And if you would just join me in thanking our speakers and our moderator.